Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Janja Lalić is a researcher, author, and educator specializing in cults, terrorist groups, extremist groups, with a focus on indoctrination and methods of influence and control. She is a retired professor of sociology and has studied the social psychology of exploitative groups and relationships for over 30 years. Janja Lalić, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, since this is National Public Radio affiliate, I want to ask you about a couple of national personalities that people hear when they listen to North State Public Radio. They have heard in the past Garrison Keillor.
Mm-hmm.
And we have known him for years. We think we know him, or we thought we knew him. And you say in your book on escaping utopia, growing up in a cult, getting out and starting over, and you say that Garrison Keillor is one of well-known people that were born or raised in a cult.
Yes, that's right. Garrison Keillor was raised in what here in America is called the Plymouth Brethren. It's an offshoot of one of the cults that's featured by one of the stories in my book called The Exclusive Brethren. That person, Joseph, which is a pseudonym, his cult was in England where Exclusive Brethren started. But then there was an offshoot here in America called Plymouth Brethren, and that's the group that Garrison Keillor grew up in and has occasionally talked about. It's a very strict, fundamentalist kind of group. And I know he mentioned it in his memoir of, you know, just like sitting silently through all these services. And so, yeah, there's, as it mentions in the book, there's a number of well-known celebrities who were born or raised or are now affiliated with various cults around the country and around the world.
Yes, you mentioned Glenn Close, actress mm-hmm. Glenn Close, Garrison Keillor, Lisa Marie Presley,
mm-hmm.
and the late actor River Phoenix.
Yes.
Are some of the people that you mentioned that they were born or raised in a cult.
That's right.
And we tend to think, I mean, I tend to think, oh, cults, that's something doesn't pertain to me, doesn't relate to me. I don't know anything about cults, or I don't know anybody that was in a cult.
Right.
I was surprised when I started reading your book and learning, oh my gosh, so this is what people go through if they're in a cult.
Right.
And you have become an expert, what, over 30 years you've been studying
right.
cults.
Yes.
And you've become an expert such that when Ira Glass was putting together a show.
I'm sorry, it was actually David Kestenbaum on This American Life, and it was a show called A Chip in My Brain, about a young boy who got his parents hired a basketball coach for him. And over more than 10 years, he was in a very controlling, what I call a cultic relationship or a one-on-one cult with this basketball coach who basically presented himself as a sort of mystical leader connected to the Illuminati and really implanted some very scary thoughts into this boy's brain. I mean, he started training with him when he was six, so he had no way to evaluate these ideas. And, of course, his parents had no clue that this was going on.
So he's so young. He's only 6 years old.
Right.
He doesn't suspect anything.
Right.
That this is some kind of charismatic figure that is in a cult, and his parents have no clue.
Right.
So they don't really know the control that this basketball coach has over this kid, because we think of cults as vast, huge numbers
right.
of people involved, and it doesn't dawn on us
mm-hmm.
that it can be a cult of just the leader, the controller, and the poor victim. I'm
exactly.
going to call it a victim.
Yeah. It's similar to, I mean, in those cases, it's very similar to a domestic violence relationship. Where the person gets under the control of the domineering figure. What's different in these cases is that there's usually some kind of ideology attached to it, Whereas in a straight domestic violence relationship, it's just going to be fear and power and maybe humiliating the person and breaking them down. But in a cultic relationship, there's that element of the ideology or the belief system that gets wrapped around it and is part of the control of the victim.
We don't think in terms of a one-on-one cult, and especially a basketball coach, Yanya, because most of us, I think, perhaps think of cults as being have a religious foundation. And we might be suspicious if they're promulgating some kind of religion, but a basketball coach?
Well, that's the one of the important things to realize about cults is that they're not all religious. There are many different kinds of cults, political cults. If we look at, say, for example, some of the white supremacist groups or other sort of racist political groups, there's therapy cults, various kinds of New Age cults. There's, gosh, I always say in my classes, there could be a chocolate chip cookie cult, you know, that they can form around any kind of belief or idea. And it's not really about the belief. It's about the structure that gets set up and how people's autonomy is taken away from them. So that's what helps to identify whether something's a cult or not.
My guest is Yanya Lalich, and she has a new book, Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out, and Starting Over. So we don't suspect a one-on-one cult. We don't think of families as being a cult. But we had some horrific news earlier this year about a family in Southern California that is just beyond belief.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, when that story broke, I was like, wow, here's a good example of a family cult. The parents kept, people may remember, the parents kept 13 children, who some of whom were adults, locked up, chained, without food, punished. They would put food in front of them but not let them eat it, put toys in boxes in front of them and not let them touch them. They were supposedly being homeschooled, and so no one ever checked on them. And for decades, I mean, the oldest one was 29, nobody ever called the police or called CPS and said something weird's going on next door. And those are the cults that what I call the family cults are sometimes the hardest to break away from and the hardest to find out about. And it's usually not until some tragedy happens that we then learn about these family cults.
Well, I think that's a reason right there for you to have written this book, because those of us who think, oh, cults don't pertain to my life.
Right.
And then if you write a book like this, people read this and say, and then their antennae go up that, what's going on here? This is not right. Something's going on that should be looked into.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, there's good and bad things about our society where we don't bother too much about other people's business. But on the other hand, we don't always look out for each other. And I think sometimes people need to pay a little more attention and sort of trust their gut when they see something that doesn't sound right. And if especially if children are involved, it can't hurt to call CPS and just have it checked out. The other thing that one of my main concerns today is homeschooling. Homeschooling has become so popular, and yet in almost every state, it's completely unregulated, unsupervised. I mean, that case that happened earlier this year in Southern California, that house was registered as a school. The father was the principal of the school. I mean, come on. And most of the cults, when I wrote this book, I interviewed 65 individuals who were born or raised in a cult. And almost to a one, they were homeschooled, which meant they were kept away from regular society. There was no intervention. They rarely had friends outside of the cult. And so homeschooling is a way that all these cults are able to get away with what they do because nobody's paying attention.
So that's one group that you wrote this book for, those of us who are just average citizens.
Right.
And who else did you write this book for?
Well, I'd say I primarily wrote the book for the children. You know, I've been, as you said, I've been studying and researching cults for about 30 years, and that started because I myself was in a cult at one point. And about 15 years ago, it became obvious that there were what some people call the second generation. there were kids who were born in these cults who were leaving. Right now, it's probably the biggest population of ex-members of cults are the children who are leaving, second and third generation. And I first sort of learned about this at a conference where there was a panel of some kids who had grown up in a cult. And at that time, I was determined to do some research. And this book is the result of that. But in speaking with these 65 individuals who were from 39 different cults, it really became clear the extent of the abuse and neglect that these children went through. And yet they have the resilience to get out. And they have, for the most part, the resilience to recover and make good lives for themselves. And so I primarily wrote the book for them. But then also I wrote the book for helping professionals. Because one of the things I learned from the interviews, which I was somewhat aware of already, but one of the things I really learned from these individuals was that when they got out of the cult, there was nowhere to go. There's no recognition of this issue. It's really a societal health problem. And they had nowhere to go. And if they managed to even get to a therapist, most therapists had no clue how to deal with or even recognize that these are cult after effects.
In fact, when I was reading the stories that these kids were or adults now, were telling about, say, the first few therapists they tried, and they described what the therapist did, I thought, are you kidding me?
Right.
I mean, you take somebody off the street, I think they would know better than to do what they did to these kids.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, not trying to harm them, but just out of ignorance.
Right. I know the one story that always got me was the young girl who went to, she was in a support group in Southern California, and she had been in a pretty abusive cult. And the leader of the support group said to her, don't talk about your experience because it'll be too much for the other people in the group to handle. And yet she says there was someone in the group who was like stabbed by his mother or his father or something. And she's like,
and
why?
Then he stabbed his father.
And then he stabbed, right. And she's like, why can he talk about that and I can't talk about my experience? And so the things they ran into were just, it was just like brick wall after brick wall. Plus, there are no social services. They can't go to domestic violence shelters because they presumably don't qualify. They don't know how to get an education. They don't know about GREs. They don't know how to get a driver's license. A lot of them end up on the streets. Unless they know of relatives that weren't in the cult that they can go to, but many times they don't or they don't have any. It's really a roller coaster for them.
In fact, that's what surprised me, that more of them didn't end up homeless with
yes.
a drug problem, an alcohol problem. And I thought, gosh, it would be so easy just
yes.
for them
well,
to
many
give
of them,
up.
Right. Well, many of them do, actually. And there have been many suicides of young people leaving cults because they feel that no one understands them. They have nowhere to go. And the one thing, I don't want to be a complete downer here, so the one thing that has been helpful is the internet. Because so many former members have begun internet groups. And so if they're able to, like, go to a library or somewhere, get onto a computer, and they search around and they find a former, a website of former members of their group, or even perhaps not their group, then they can find a community to help them.
After a break, I'll be back with my guest, Janja Lalić, co-author of Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out, and Starting Over. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is retired sociology professor Janja Lalić, a cult survivor and expert on cults. Well, I remember one woman telling her story, and as she was looking at her story, she happened to have grown up in Scientology. And she said, "Wow, what a brave kid. I really admire her." And she was expressing exactly my reaction to these stories. When I was reading these stories, I thought, oh my gosh, here are kids that started with nothing. They went on to perhaps get a GRE, a college education. And I thought, wow, I really admire these kids. Yeah. And that's what she said. And she realized, oh, that's me.
Right, right. Now, I mean, one of the things we addressed in the book is this whole issue of resilience. You know, like, why do some people succeed and some don't? And I don't think there's ever really been found an answer to that question. But it is quite remarkable because many of these people, I mean, when they get out, they're various ages. Sometimes they're in adolescence, sometimes they're older, sometimes they're in their 40s. I mean, it depends. But they, most of them do manage to make really good lives for themselves. They can run into misfortune, like the woman in the book who talked about, you know, she spent, I forget how many thousands of dollars getting some kind of training and then found out it wasn't legitimate.
Unaccredited.
It was unaccredited
college.
And it didn't do her any good because she didn't know about that.
Thousands of dollars she did not have.
Right, right. So, you know, it's hit and miss, but many of them go on, and many of them are very dedicated to helping other people, either from their cult or other cults. They've started organizations. They've set up scholarships to help other kids go on to school. They're quite a remarkable population.
They are, and I was impressed by that, their desire to help others that have been in their situation. And the fact they go on to higher education, they give up, they sacrifice a lot. It takes a tremendous amount of courage to do what some of these kids did with their lives.
Right. And I think especially because there's still such a stigma in our society about cults. You know, people think, oh, these are kooky, wacky people. They wanted to be led around by the nose, you know. They don't even think about the children who were, they didn't choose it, as is, you know, the title of one of our chapters, like, we didn't choose to be here. So there's such a stigma, it's not easy to come out and say, oh yeah, I was in a cult, now will you help me? Many of them just kind of crawl into the woodwork because they don't want to share it, or they don't know how to share it, and they don't think that people will understand.
My guest is Janja Lalić, and she is co-author of a book, Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out, and Starting Over. And some of these people, they're quite intelligent. I was impressed by that. They go on to get PhDs, and you yourself are an example of that.
Yes.
You and your co-author both are cult survivors.
Yes.
And I'm sure people listening said, well, what's Janja's story?
Well, my story is when I was about 30 years old, I had been living in Europe for a number of years, and I came back to America. So I was new in San Francisco making friends, and I ran into some people. And this was after the end of the Vietnam War, and I had, you know, sort of leftist liberal ideas myself at the time. And I was asked to join a study group. I didn't know that the study group was a front for a cult, which is a typical way people get recruited. And eventually I joined the background organization, and I spent 10 and a half years in what was a very restrictive, controlled, not so much physically, but definitely psychologically abusive group. We spent a good part of our time sitting around in circles, being criticized or criticizing each other. People were completely broken down. And yet we had, you know, our members were doctors, lawyers, people with PhDs. I myself was a, you know, had graduated from college with honors from the University of Wisconsin. So it's not stupid people who get into these groups. What I found, if there is a common denominator, it's idealism. It's people who want to create a better world or a better self or a better family, you know, and that's what leads them to join something. So when I got out, I was about 41 years old.
So you were in that cult for that long?
Yes, and I was a wreck. I moved to New York. I'd been in San Francisco most of that time. I moved to New York because I wanted to get as far away as I could from San Francisco. I got a job in publishing because I built and ran the publishing house in the cult. And I was a mess. I mean, I would go home every night and try to write my story because that's what I'd always been drawn to. And I would just sit at my, in those days it was electric typewriters. I would sit at my little typewriter and cry and drink and cry and try to figure out what had happened to me. And it wasn't until one day my boss took me out. It was my 6-month anniversary at that job, and he took me out for dinner. And so we're in this fancy French restaurant, and he looks at me and he says, "You know, Yanya, you're a great worker. All your work is superb, everything you do. But there's one thing I have to say. You've been here six months now, and I've never seen you smile, and I've never heard you laugh."
Oh.
And I was so struck by that because I've always considered myself kind of a funny person. <You know? laughs> And I went home and I thought, wow, this isn't the me. This isn't yet me. And so from that point on, I got into therapy. And at the time in New York, there was a cult clinic, a clinic of therapists who specialized in working with people who got out of cults. And so I was very lucky because my therapist did understand the after effects. And that really helped me. But it was a rough time. It was particularly rough because I had been in leadership and I had done a lot of things that, you know, afterwards I really regretted. So recovery is not easy.
You mentioned that you got involved with this in San Francisco, and in your book, one of the stories, this cult starts out back east, and then this was a martial arts figure, and she moves her group to the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think if I lived in the Bay Area, I would really have my feelers out for watching for this sort of thing.
Well, it's not just the Bay Area. I mean, cults exist all around the country, all over the country. I mean, a number of them go to places like California or Hawaii because the weather's nice and the cult leader can think they have a good life. But, you know, there's cults in the Midwest. There's cults in the South. There's cults all over the world.
Well, since I mentioned this one, this martial artist who moved her group to the Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
I guess we can kind of understand that, but we don't, that's not one of the first things that come to mind. Again, we think in terms of religion, but she really promoted herself as a religious figure.
Yes, she did. I mean, first she claimed she was a grandmaster in the kind of martial art that she taught, which no one's ever been able to verify. But then secondly, she put a sort of Christian twist on it and said, you know, she was bringing them to Jesus. And so, but there were pictures of her all over the house and they had to bow to her and say, "Grandmaster." And you know, the girl whose story is in the book talks about how she could never really have friends over. And the one time she did bring friends over, they were wondering, like, why is she bowing to this picture? And, you know, what is this woman's picture all over the house about? And people who joined that group, I mean, you couldn't be a couple. The couples were immediately separated. The men lived in one house. The women lived in another house. She was not raised by her parents, which is often typical in a cult. But yeah, that's what I was saying earlier. The cults can exist under any form of belief. It's about what the leader does, how the leader promotes that belief, and then how the structure is set up to implement the leader's wishes.
Well, now, this woman intentionally, I gathered from your story, set herself up as this greater than human being, just
yes.
about. And yet, I think sometimes it's the other way around, that the members of the cult so want to put their leader on a pedestal that the leader might start out with the best of intentions. And I think in terms of yoga gurus, and they may start out with the best of intentions, but then they get this adulation that goes to their head.
Yes, although I think it takes a particular personality to run with that. You know, there's plenty of decent yoga groups. And again, there's plenty of corrupt gurus. So I think the type of personality that's going to become a cult leader, that's going to run with that unbridled power, you know, has to have a desire to control, has to have at least a dab, if not a bit more, of narcissism, and sort of this desire for power. I mean, cult leaders are about money, sex, or power, one or all three or a combination of those three. So what it starts with, what every cult starts with, is the charismatic leader. And I think what's important about charisma is to understand that charisma is a relationship. And we say charisma is in the eye of the beholder. So you have to believe that that person is special, right? So I can take you to a group and I can be gaga over guru baba wawa. And you can get there and say, oh, you know, this guy's a charlatan. But for me, you know, he's the be-all and end-all. So you probably aren't going to join. But someone else who comes and feels that specialness is going to probably come back again. So it's this charismatic relationship that sets up a sort of obligation on the part of the follower to obey this special master. So in a sense, yes, they give him or her the power. And then that person, if he's got his screws loose,
he's vulnerable to that sort of thing,
is going to run with it, right? And as we know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so the domineering type of personality is going to set up rules, you know, to not question him, that he's got all the answers. The lieutenants around him are going to help enforce that. And the newer members or the lower level members are going to fall into, you know, fall into pattern with that because they're being modeled that by the older members. And the longer you're in, the harder it is to leave.
My guest is Janja Lalić, and she is co-author of a book, Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out, and Starting Over. This is not your first book. Mm-hmm. And the reason I want to go back to a previous book of yours, and this was the title of this book was Bounded Choice, True Believers and Charismatic Cults. And the title of that book, Bounded Choice, that theory comes up frequently in your new book. And so would you explain your theory of bounded choice?
Sure. My book that came out in 2004, Bounded Choice, was basically a sort of rewrite of my dissertation. Eventually, after I got out of the cult, I went to grad school and got my PhD. So bounded choice is both a framework and a theory for trying to understand cults. And what I was looking at is, why do people in cults do what they do that to us on the outside looks so unbelievable, so irrational, so weird?
So we would never fall for that.
Yes, of course we would never fall for that, of course, but I did. But so the bounded choice framework has four parts to it, which is the charismatic authority, which we just talked about, the belief system, which I call a transcendent belief system, which is the belief system that offers you everything. It gives you the answer to the past, present, and future. Now, many religions or many organizations might have that kind of belief system. What's different in a cult is that along with that comes what I call the recipe for change. They tell you exactly how you need to change to be on that path to salvation or revolution or whatever they're offering. Exactly. So it's not like, oh, you go to a church and they say, you know, be nice to your neighbors. But nobody's coming to check on you to see if you've brought a basket of fruit over to your neighbors when they moved into your neighborhood, right? Or they say, don't use birth control. But nobody's coming into your bedroom at night and checking, right? So when I say recipe of change, I mean that that's something that you absolutely have to abide by. And then the third and fourth aspects are what I call the systems of influence and the systems of control, which are the overt rules and regulations, and then the more subtle peer pressure and modeling and some of the things I talked about earlier. So that structure, once you get into that structure and you're recruited and then brought into the indoctrination phase where you're instilled with these ideas, you're trained, you're gone through some kind of education program, until you get to the point where you've actually internalized not only the belief system, but the rules and regulations, right? So you're, in a sense, controlling yourself. You know exactly how you're supposed to behave. You could be on the other side of the world, and you would know what you need to do to stay loyal and to stay faithful, right, and to be abiding by what the leader wants. When you get to that point, you're so enveloped in that system. I call that a bounded reality. it's a self-sealing system. Everything is contained within that world. So even though you may be going to a job every day, in your mind, you're in this other world. And the job doesn't really mean anything except maybe you're supposed to be recruiting people there or something, right? So you're in this bounded reality and you have so internalized the system that you get to this state of mind that I call bounded choice, which is in part a way to confront the issue of free will. Because people will say, oh, well, they joined on their own, or, oh, they sat there and said, I want to commit suicide for my cult leader, right, as the Heaven's Gate people did. No, this is a situation of bounded choice, which means that, yes, you have a choice. Nobody's holding a gun to your head, but you know exactly the decision that you need to make in order to stay loyal, not be punished, not be expelled. And it's that conundrum, that absolute vice sort of on your brain that keeps people entrenched in these groups and gets people to do things that they wouldn't normally do.
In fact, you say that charisma becomes toxic.
Yes. Yes.
And yet the people who are involved or under the spell of this charismatic authority don't see that.
No, they don't see it, although I have to say from my own experience and also from the so many people I've talked to over the years, you know, if you're a decent human being, if you're not a bit of a psychopath yourself, which sometimes psychopaths get in these groups and then they become a leader or they break off and start their own group, but if you're a decent human being with some kind of moral sensibility, there are often things that are going to bother you. You'll see things and you'll think, I don't know. But you can't express it because you know if you express it, something horrible is going to happen to you or your family or whatever. So you kind of put it in the back of your head and you put it in the back of your head. And I think the reason people end up leaving groups is that little shelf with all those things piled up on it, one day there's going to be one too many things on that shelf and it's going to break. And the person's going to realize they need to get out of there. And then it's a matter of figuring out how to get out of there, which is often very difficult to do.
Sometimes it takes them more than one attempt.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, sometimes people leave and they come back because they're guilty or they're afraid. You get out in the world and you think, oh, well, maybe the leader's right. Maybe I've just given up salvation. Oh, my God, I better run back.
Because often they describe it as like being on another planet.
Yes, yes.
They come to this of the world that we know, mm-hmm. and it's so alien to them.
Yes, and that really struck me when I was interviewing the people for this book, that almost to a one, when we got to the place of talking about leaving the group, almost to a one, they said, I felt like I just landed from Mars. I mean, it was just so interesting, and that's especially true for those who grew up in cults, because they don't know any other world. And especially if they're in a very restrictive group where they're on a compound or someplace or extremely isolated. I mean, the world is completely alien to them, and they've been indoctrinated to fear the outside world. You know, this is Satan, this is evil, this is murder, this is horrendous life. So it's not an easy decision to, like, give up everything and break through that door.
And it's so hard for them to feel like they can fit in, which mm-hmm. they really want to do. And yet it's so hard. Not only they want to, but the people around them, if they go to a school, they're of school age, their peers are going to look at them askance and right. they're not going to be a part of that in crowd because they don't know what clothes to wear. They don't know how to wear their hair.
Right.
There's so much that they don't know about.
Right. They don't know social skills. They don't know how to date. There's so much struggling around that. They don't know how to trust anyone anymore, so they don't know how to make friendships. They either say too much or say too little. I mean, they don't often know the basic. I mean, the one girl in the book talks about how the first time, you know, she was able to shop on her own and she goes in the grocery store and she's just like overwhelmed by all the cereals and all the different kinds
yes,
of food.
Tried all those
right,
dry cereals.
Right. And then remember, mm-hmm. she's the one who like loved jam and she would
yes.
buy tons of jam.
She never had
kinds.
That before.
Right. And she would buy all this jam and she had a roommate who, you know, would say to her, what, you know, thought she was so weird because she'd bring home all this jam all the time. So, you know, everything's just like explosively new.
We're going to take a break, and then I'll continue my conversation with cult survivor Janja Lalić, co-author of Escaping Utopia. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with researcher and cult survivor Janja Lalić, author of Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out, and Starting Over. So when they do, if they are successful in their attempts to get out, they have to start a new life.
Yes.
From scratch, pretty much.
From scratch, which is very different from people like myself who joined as an adult, right? I had already been to college. I had family. I had friends who hadn't been part of the cult. I could go back to those people. I could go back to my parents and say, you know, show me scrapbooks from when I was a kid so I can remember who I am. But the kids who grew up in cults, they don't have any of that. So when they come out, it's literally like rebuilding themselves from scratch. They have to figure out everything. They have to figure out their not just their beliefs, but their moral code, you know, their sense of ethics, how to survive, how to open a bank account, every single little thing.
In fact, when I was reading these stories and I would try to imagine myself in their shoes, and I would be so overwhelmed that I could see this one woman said she started drinking, she started experimenting with drugs, mm-hmm. and I could see how that would be so easy to do when you're just so overwhelmed
right.
with this new place in life you find yourself in.
Right, right. The lucky ones will have some family members, you know, who weren't in the cult, who they can find and go back to. Or, as I was saying earlier, they might find help on the internet. And those are the ones who are lucky.
In fact, I was thinking of Jessica, mm-hmm. the one who said she started drinking a lot and experimenting with drugs. She's the one that the first counselor she had just made things worse for her instead of better.
Right. I believe she's the one where she was in the cult where they had sex with the children. Children of God is the name of that cult, or the family. And the counselor wanted to hear all about her sexual experiences.
Yeah, you know? She said one counselor was kept asking her about the fact that she had sex when she was just, 6 years old?
Right,
I think it was.
Right.
And he seemed overly interested in that aspect.
Right, right. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing people would run into. And you have to really applaud their courage for carrying on.
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
And then here was the case of Jessica, who was self-medicating. But there are medications for people who have PTSD, mm-hmm. which is the case for a lot of these people.
Yes.
And you do say in your book that, especially for these clients, PTSD, that medication should be considered.
Yes. I mean, I'm not a pill pusher by any means, but anxiety and panic attacks are one of the most common after effects when people get out of cults, both adults and these kids who were raised in a cult. And, you know, seen people over the years, and they're so troubled, and they're having these panic attacks, and they're, you know, and I would say to them, you don't need to suffer this much. You know, there are medications that are not addictive that can help you get through these rough periods where you can, you know, start to get a grasp on things and be able to, like, set up a routine and a regular schedule and not just be constantly overwhelmed. And the hard part about that is, for one, this issue of trust, them trusting a doctor, you know, because a lot of them were groups where they weren't allowed any kind of medical care.
Oh, that was right. Just terrible reading about those situations. But right. Anyway,
And secondly, they're used to suffering, right? Suffering is what they've known. So they think, oh, I'm suffering. That's what life's about.
That's normal.
Suffering. Right. So it's a matter of getting through those humps with them to get the ones who could really be helped with certain medications for a limited time.
So medication can play a role in
medication,
healing.
Medication, yes.
And then you have a statement in your book, which given the fact that you're a retired professor is not surprising. You say education is vital for their healing.
Yes, yes. Education, which I call psychoeducation. Mm-hmm. Basically learning about cults, learning about not just their own cult, but also how this kind of social psychological manipulation works. So often when we work with people, we might like show them films of other cults and they can see the similarities and go, oh, well, my cult did that, but they called it something else. So that kind of education so that they're able to understand how that system worked on them, because there's always so much guilt and shame, like even for the kids. It's like, why didn't I leave sooner? Why didn't I run away sooner? Why didn't I grab my brother and sister and go? And they have to understand the enormity of this kind of social structure that they were living under, that it's not that easy to just get up and go. So once they can forgive themselves for that and get over the guilt and get over the shame, their road to recovery will be a lot shorter.
I was interested in the fact that one woman was asked, well, where did you go to school? Mm. And she replied, Barnes and Noble. Because she said that's what she did. She read a lot.
Right.
On her own initiative. So that's another reason I admire these people that you interviewed, because they took responsibility mm-hmm. for educating themselves, and like in her case, mm-hmm. to make sure she read a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's what I mean about resilience. I mean, the ones who are able to really, you know, find the wherewithal to do what they need to do. The girl who got into the drinking and drugs, you know, she got out of that. The people who have to like crash around and live on couches, they'll eventually find their way out of that. And it's having the sort of self strength, you know, to be able to keep moving forward and hopefully having other support along the way. And certainly as a society, we need to be offering more support.
My guest is Janja Lalić, and her newest book is Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out, and Starting Over. And you've been mentioning you interviewed a lot of people. How did you go about doing this? Because not all these people lived here in the United States.
Right. Well, first of all, I have to thank the University of Chico State, because I was a professor at the time, working full-time, and got a number of grants from our dean at the time, Gail Hutchinson, who's now our president, to be able to do this research. So many of the interviews were by phone. They were recorded. Some were done in person where they were within reach, Southern California, the Bay Area. And so those were in-person interviews. But primarily they were by phone. And those interviews were tough. I mean, they were hour and a half, 2 hours long. Sometimes I talked to somebody more than once. Sometimes I'd get off the phone and I would just cry for like an hour. Because, you know, while you're on the phone doing the interview, you have to be the objective researcher. Yeah. And so you have to remain calm. But I would hear such stories of neglect and abuse. So once all the interviews were done, which I met most people through word of mouth, through the internet, through these various ex-member support group internet sites. And then the tapes were transcribed by students. I had a number of my students at the time help with transcribing the tapes, entering the data from the questionnaires that I had each person fill out. Then all of that had to be coded. The interviews were printed out. I have six giant binders at home.
Now, you coded them so that you could access when you needed to refer to some particular.
Right. We coded for patterns, the kind of, you know, both positive and negative patterns. So there were, I think, 65 or 70 codes for things that happened or patterns within the cult, and then another 60 or so once they left the cult. So things like relationship with their family, education, you know, whatever it might be. And so those things are all coded, and then you kind of match these codes and you keep paring them down. And then when I got together with my co-author, who actually is also a graduate of Chico State, she and I talked for a long time about how are we going to approach this. This is 65 interviews. Like, what are we going to do with all this data? Yes. So we decided to pick six people who were more or less representative of the whole group and follow those six individuals through the book. And then also, as we went along, we pulled in excerpts and quotes from some of the other individuals as well. And then we used the bounded choice framework to sort of give the book a structure and help readers see how this works and what are the kinds of things to look out for in their own life. And as you know, each chapter ends with checklists, like what's a bad charismatic relationship and what could be good about a charismatic relationship, sort of to help readers be able to spot these things in their lives today.
So when there's a degree of self-selection, the people who are willing to cooperate with you, mm-hmm. and that, to me, their motivation has to be wanting to help others.
Yes.
Because otherwise, why would they do this? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that they did this because if I cooperate with this researcher, I can perhaps help others
yes.
who won't suffer what I did exactly.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think anyone was doing it sort of with the motivation to, like, expose the cult. It's not what it was about. It was about helping people and learning from their experience and their story. And as you know, the last couple chapters in the book deal with the part of starting over. And, you know, so with each person I asked, like, what worked for you and what didn't work for you? If anything could have existed out in the world once you got out here, what would you have liked? And so those are things that I included toward the end of the book. So hopefully both helping professionals as well as other people leaving cults can be able to tap into that.
Because if somebody's a therapist and this is not their specialty, they get a client, walks in the door and says, I was a part of a cult. And what would the therapist do then? Do you think they know? Now, with the internet, they probably could find your book.
I hope so.
And educate themselves
right.
on the do's and don'ts
yes.
of helping somebody
yes.
as a therapist.
Yeah. I mean, I think hopefully people are a little more aware today. And both my other book, Take Back Your Life, which was also about recovery, had some things in it for especially for therapists. But I think generally, often when someone goes to a therapist, the therapist is going to say, well, let's talk about your childhood. What happened when you were two, right? And that isn't necessarily going to help. They first have to kind of unpack the cult stuff. And then they can sort of go back if they need to. But a person leaving a cult, even someone who grew up in a cult, has to understand what the impact of that particular experience was on them, both psychologically, emotionally, physically, whatever, you know, in whatever ways the cult manifested its punishments and things like that. And so, and many people go, I'd say probably a huge percentage are going to have PTSD. And so need to be diagnosed for that. And there's special kinds of treatments and therapy for that. And so that all needs to be recognized by the therapist. And so I definitely feel that therapists need training in this. They need to read my book and a few others that are out there that can help with that because this is a growing population.
In fact, I wonder, too, if the therapist realized the suicide rate or the attempted suicides in this group.
Right.
You get those statistics. How likely is it that somebody in this situation is going to want to commit suicide?
Well, it's higher than the average suicide rate. And it is that sense of despair. And often it's, you know, for most of these people, once they leave the group, they can have no contact with anyone still in the group. these are people who left on their own. They have to leave their family behind. They can never have any contact with their family again. You know, some of them talked about how, you know, their parents died or their grandparents died. They didn't even know. No one tells them. So it's like, you know, cutting off your arms and your legs. It's that is over. That part of your life is over. Sometimes they're declared hostile. You know, not just their family, but even other people in the cult can't talk to them. So depending, again, on where they live, if they're in a small town and a good part of the town is in that cult or knows about that, you know, it's a very, very lonely time.
They're very isolated.
Very isolating. And so that's why the kind of help from social services is so important.
My guest is Janja Lalić. She is co-author of Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out, and Starting Over. And you say your co-author, Carla McLaren, is a Chico State graduate. Did she happen to seek out your classes?
No, what happened was she was taking sociology classes and online. She was an online student. And her professor, who was in our department, you know, she was a sociology major, mentioned me to her and said, oh, you've got to talk to Dr. Lalić. And so we started talking, and then she graduated. I did an independent study. I was her professor for an independent study where she did some work with me, and then she graduated. She lives in Santa Rosa and then went on to get her master's degree in education. And she grew up in a cult. She was kicked out of the cult when she was 17 and was homeless. Her parents were involved. So we always just stayed in touch. And then when I was, frankly, having trouble getting this book done because of teaching full time, and I thought, oh, maybe I should get Carla in on this project because she's brilliant. She's an excellent writer. She knows about cults. She's had personal experience, and it'll make me get things done because I'll have somebody bugging me and we can bug each other. And so that's how we came to be co-authors.
Well, there is so much in your book that is uplifting. I mean, a lot of it is hard to read, but I like the fact that you conclude your book with a quote from somebody. Joseph is not his real name. The last paragraph, he says, live your life with zest.
Yes.
And I'd like to conclude with that wonderful piece of advice. It's been such a pleasure talking to you,
Thank
Janja.
You. Thanks for having me on the show, Nancy.
My guest has been Janja Lalić. Her newest book is Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out, and Starting Over. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.